This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, actor Danny Trejo, came of age in the California prison system, doing time in a juvenile detention center as well as San Quentin, Folsom, and Soledad on charges relating to drugs and robberies to buy drugs. As an actor, he's best known for his menacing roles, like a character who was nicknamed after his weapon of choice.
They called him Machete.
The movie Machete began as a fake, ironic movie trailer in the Quentin Tarantino Robert Rodriguez film Grindhouse.
Set up, double-crossed, and left foot dead. He knows the score. He gets the women. And he kills the bad guys.
A few years after the fake trailer, Rodriguez decided to actually make the movie Machete, starring Trejo. Danny Trejo's other best-known role was in Breaking Bad. He played Tortuga, who winds up being decapitated with his head mounted on a living tortoise. Long story, but if you saw Breaking Bad, you remember that scene. I love how Trejo's career was described by Amos Barshad writing in the magazine Grantland. Quote, Trejo has been stabbed, shot, maimed, crushed, hung, choked, decapitated, and blown to bits. He's had hypodermic needles jabbed into his neck. He's had a power drill run through his brain. Charles Bronson and Robert De Niro have killed him. Stone Cold Steve Austin and 50 Cent have killed him. Mickey Rourke has killed him twice. Unquote. Trejo still returns to prisons to talk with inmates. Now he's the producer of a documentary called Survivor's Guide to Prison, which focuses on injustices within the criminal justice system and highlights the cases of two men who spent decades behind bars for murders they didn't commit. Trejo is one of the people who speaks in the film, which is now streaming on Amazon and iTunes. Danny Trejo first started using drugs when he was 8 years old. Danny Trejo, welcome to Fresh Air. You said it was your uncle who introduced you to drugs and to crime. What did he introduce you to, and why did he do it?
Well, you know, at first it was marijuana, and this was in the 50s. Now, you ask, people ask, well, was weed a gateway drug? And I say, I don't know. The only thing I know is that everybody that I knew in prison that did heroin, that did cocaine, that did PCP, that did acid, started with marijuana.
Did heroin become your drug of choice?
Yes.
How long did it take for that to happen?
My uncle gave me a fix when I was about 12.
How can he do that? I mean, that seems like terrible thing to do.
I know. In his defense, I got to say that I threatened to snitch on him if he didn't give me some, because I caught him fixing, and I said, give me some. And he said, no, give me some or I'll tell. So basically, he gave me some, and I was off and running. I hung out with my uncle from there on.
Was it through your uncle that you continued to get drugs once you were addicted? I mean, a 12-year-old doesn't have the means to support a habit.
It was basically through my uncle. I stayed, you know, around him a lot, and then I knew all the people he knew. And
where were your parents while this was happening?
They were, you know, trying to be positive Republicans. You know, I mean, they wanted to, you know, have a home and a camper and a Cadillac, and they were great parents. But the reality was, my dad was, you know, hard worker. I gotta get ahead. We gotta pay these bills. And my mom was, I gotta clean this house. We have to start dinner at 1:30 because your dad gets home at 5. You know, and that was the way it was. And I was the only child, so that's just the way it was.
But it sounds like maybe you were much more influenced by your uncle than by your parents.
Completely.
So were your parents not paying enough attention to you, or were you just not paying enough attention to them?
That sounds so like, oh, my mommy didn't pay attention. No, you know, I wanted to be left alone.
My impression was that you didn't want the life, that kind of stable life that they wanted.
Oh, God. I don't think it's up to a kid whether he wants to be. I think it's up to parents. No, I'm butting into your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I stayed in my kid's business. And even though, with all the knowledge I had and with everything that I knew, my kids still went and used drugs. But thank God they knew where to go when it was time for them to wait a minute. I've had enough.
In movie roles, you're famous for being really tough and very menacing when you need to be.
Yeah.
Was that an asset for you in prison? Was that something you
Absolutely.
Knew how to use when you were in prison?
Absolutely. There's two types of people in prison. There's predator and prey. You have to decide every day which you're going to be. And it's that simple. The more intimidating, the more people you have behind you, because I've never seen a fist fight in prison. Do you understand? It's so much easier to stab somebody and walk away than it is, because if you get in a fight, if I sock you, you're going to sock me back. And then we're going to tussle, and then they're going to shoot us. But if I walk up behind you, stab you three times, and walk away, I'm not going to get caught. And that is the idea, not to get caught. You've done something wrong, and this is what happens. That's why in prison, they say the bottom line to any argument is a murder.
So how did you turn yourself into a convincing predator so that you wouldn't be prey?
Have you ever seen me?
Yes, I have. That's a good answer.
That's how I got in the movies. but you go to prison the first time because now it's so easy to go to prison your first time arrested. And so now when you go to prison, all of a sudden you have not been brought up in this lifestyle. So if you were in juvenile hall, in youth authority, and then in prison, that means you went to prep school, you went to graduate school, now you're in the university, and you know how to behave. You know what to do, what not to do. If you're there for the first time, you're walking around asking, hey, can you help me? Hey, buddy, could you tell me where the pool is? You know, so it's like all of a sudden you're lost. You're not in your element.
So you came up through the system, so you knew,
yeah.
You know what to do. Okay, so something that really helped you in your later life as an actor, it helped get you into acting, is that you became a lightweight and welterweight champion in prison.
Yeah,
so
boxing. That was my uncle again. My uncle started boxing in golden gloves, and I was his sparring partner, a punching bag. And so I either had to learn how to fight or get my head kicked in, and he taught me how to fight. So basically, anything you're good at, you can use. Like some people are real good at writing letters. Well, that's a way to protect yourself. Some people are real good at fighting. That's, you know, boxing, I think, kept me out of a lot of trouble.
What happened to your uncle? Did he do time too, and is he still alive?
Oh yeah, he did about 20-some years, and then he overdosed.
Why do you think you were able to give up drugs and stay out of prison eventually? Like, how old were you when that happened, and what was the turning point for you?
Cinco de Mayo, 1968. Me, Ray Pacheco, Henry Quijada, I can say that because I think they were both killed in robberies. We were involved in a prison riot, went to the hole, and expected to go to the gas chamber.
What were you accused of?
Inciting a riot. And by the grace of God, I can remember saying, God, if you're there, if you let me die with some dignity, I will say your name every day, and I will do whatever I can to help my fellow man. And really, I thought it was just going to be a couple of years, then they were going to kill me, but it wasn't. It's like he fooled me and gave me the rest of my life.
So I'm interested in hearing your story about how you went from coming of age in prison to getting out, eventually becoming a youth drug counselor, work that you're still doing, and having a movie career. I mean, it's not like you were studying acting while you were in prison.
Well, you know, it's funny, but when people say, where did you study? I always think standing on the yard in San Quentin, knowing that there's a riot coming, you're absolutely scared to death with every fiber of your body. You know, I might get killed right now, and you have to, like, pretend you're not. You know, you have to stand there and make everybody think you like it. You know, you can't even sweat. It's like you're standing there, you just got this smirk on your face like, yeah, we're going to do it now. Oh, yeah. And people around you see that and go, yeah, yeah. And then you just build everybody up. And all of a sudden, there's no fear. It's all rage. And you know, 10, 15 people in rage is a really powerful force.
So you're saying you did learn how to act in prison.
That's, yeah, how to act not afraid.
Right, right. So you didn't need to study the method or Stanislavski or anything.
No,
to,
yeah, I always out. Joke about my acting coach, Juan Strasberg. You know what? You're the only one that's ever laughed at that. When I always say, my acting coach, Juan Strasberg, people think, oh, is that a...
Is that a person?
Yeah.
Tell us the story of how you were first cast in a movie.
Okay. The way I got into the movie business, you know, running around trying to be an extra. They should give you $50 for being an extra. I ran into a good friend of mine, a guy named Eddie Bunker, who was a great writer, and people don't know it. Eddie actually got famous because he could write writs in prison. That's one of the reasons why the Department of Corrections hated him.
Oh, W-R-I-T-S, like...
Writs, you know, a writ to get you out of prison.
Oh, okay.
Like a writ of habeas corpus. He would charge people, and he would get their documents, and he'd look at them, and he'd go, hey, wait a minute, hold right here. They violated your blah, 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 blah. And he would write a writ. Now, a writ has to be grammatically correct. It has to be written in the language of the court. So basically, they've stacked the deck against you because nobody knows that stuff but attorneys. But Eddie knew how to do it. So people would pay him. He'd write a writ. You'd come back to court. And he got a lot of people out of prison. And so when I ran into him on a movie called Runaway Train with John Voight and Eric Roberts, he asked me if I was still boxing because he had saw me win the lightweight and welterweight title up in San Quentin, and I was lightweight and welterweight title of every institution I was in. And so he said, are you still boxing? And I said, Eddie, I'm 40 years old. I don't get hit in the face anymore. I train. I'm in shape. And he says, we need somebody to train one of the actors how to box. And I said, what's it pay? And he said, $320 a day. And I said, how bad you want this guy beat up? You know, because $320 a day, that was more money I was making a week. And I was a drug counselor, right? And he goes, no, you have to be real careful, Danny. This actor's real high strung. He might sock you. I said, Eddie, for $320 a day, give him a stick. Are you crazy? I've been beat up for free, Holmes. And I started training Eric Roberts how to box.
How did he do?
He can't fight. And then and then Andrei Kozielowski had Eric.
He was the director of the film.
Yeah, Andrei Kozielowski was the director. Very soft-spoken Russian. Beautiful man. I mean, he wore those funny sweaters with the leather on the, you know, on the elbows.
Oh, the elbow patches.
And cardigan, and just was real, always had these sweaters on, and just soft-spoken. And he didn't understand. Eric was a movie star. Okay, now movie stars yell and scream and walk to their trailers and stuff, you know what I mean? So Andre couldn't really understand what was, you know, because like I said, you don't do that in Russia. And so when he saw Eric was listening to me as far as boxing and stuff, he came over, Andre comes over and says, you be in movie, you fight Eric, and you be my friend. I'll never get that. And you be my friend. Now, if you have a prison background, you don't like people to say, you be my friend. You know, because you just, yeah, no, yeah, you'll be my friend. And so, and I'll never get that. He leans over and he kisses me on one cheek, kisses me on the other cheek, and then he walks away. I told Eddie Bunker, Eddie, I'm going to train that kid for $320 a day, but if I'm going to be kissing that old man, I want more money. And I'll never forget, they had somebody cast. And I remember Andre going, no, 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 look. And he went to Eric's face and he goes, ah. And then he went to this other guy they had cast who looked a little like Antonio Banderas. Goes, ah. And then he came to me and went, look. Contrast. He kept saying contrast. I didn't know if he was like making fun of me or not, but he wanted contrast. So I got the job.
So do I have this right? Because I read an interview with you in which you said that before you were on the set of Runaway Train, you were working mm-hmm. as a drug counselor, and a teenager who you were working with was on the set and asked you to come with him because he was having trouble staying away from drugs, and he was worried he was going to succumb. So you accompanied him to the set, and there they asked you to box.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I had been
teach Eric Robertson. You ran into Edward Bunker.
That's exactly. I'd been working as an extra, and this kid was trying to stay clean, and he was a PA, production assistant, and. I don't know what happened to him, but running into Eddie changed my life again.
So to give a sense of some of the small parts you had before becoming better known, I'm going to read
I was inmate number one.
Inmate number one. I'm going to read some of the titles of films that you were in, and some of these date back to before Runaway Train. Okay. Lock Up, Bulletproof, Death Wish 4, The Crackdown, Penitentiary 3, Carnal Crimes, Double Crossed, Whore, Guns, Marked for Death, Maniac Cop 2. That just takes us to 1990. And your roles include prisoner, tattoo artist. So that'll give a sense of some of how some of the roles.
Yeah, you know what? Right now, they're doing a documentary on my life right now, and it's called Inmate Number One. And the reason is because I played Inmate Number One in just about. The minute I would walk, I'd be inmate number one. I thought I had a great career going, you know, because I was making $320 a day, and sometimes I'd work 3 or 4 days. And I can remember the first time I got interviewed, this young lady, probably fresh out of interview school, she says, and then she was Latina.
Is there an interview school?
but she was Latina, so immediately she says, Danny, don't you feel you're being stereotyped? And I says, what are you talking about? She says, well, you know, you always play the mean Chicano dude with tattoos. And I thought about it. I says, I am the mean Chicano dude with tattoos. Somebody finally got it right. They're not using Marky Wahlberg to be the mean Chicano dude.
So I want to ask you about your role in Breaking Bad.
And that was fun.
You play Tortuga, which also means, in Spanish, that means turtle. So you're an informant for the DEA.
Uh-huh.
And in this scene, you're meeting with DEA agent Hank Schrader, who's played by Dean Norris. He's going to you for information, but you're taking your time. You're really toying with him. And so
I had one of those books from the airlines.
I
want to order two of these.
It's the catalog that you can order from while you're in the plane. So you're taking your sweet time. You're trying to show that you're the one in control here, not the DEA agent. So Hank is sitting there with his fellow DEA agents while you're toying with them, and you say to one of them, hey, give me that SkyMall on the table over there. And then you start ordering things from SkyMall and giving out the catalog number for each item. So this is the scene. You speak first.
Hey, white boy, better learn Espanol, huh? This ain't Branson, Missouri. You know what I'm talking about? You know what? I'll teach you. Vamos a hacer un negocio. It means, let's make a deal.
So go ahead. We're waiting.
Okay, vaya. Right here. Item SS. 4G, Yankee Stadium, final season, commemorative baseball. Hand signed by Derek Jeter. Banco, write this down. Oh, man, watch out. 66100ZBG, large size floor runner. Look at that. It's a rug you put on the floor, except for it looks like a $100 bill. I love them. Get me 20 of them. I'm going to put them all over my casa.
We'll get you 3.
Hey, you give me 10.
5.
You must have pagar taxes.
Hey, how about you stop jerking us off here? Where's the meat? When's it going down?
White boy don't like, let's make a deal, huh?
White boy's gonna kick your ass. You don't stop wasting his time.
Schrader.
Hey, white boy. My name's Tortuga. You know what that means?
If I'd have to guess, I'd say that's Spanish for ass.
Tortuga means turtle. That's me. I take my time, but I always win.
Okay, so finally you make the deal. You give the agents the information they're looking for. And
the Emmy goes to Danny Trejo for Tortuga.
and so the agents are... You've tipped them off to when there's going to be a deal going down, drug deal going down. They're in the desert waiting for this drug deal to go down. And what they see is this turtle walking toward them, this big, large tortoise with your decapitated head on it.
Yeah.
Because your boss knows that you informed.
Yeah.
And so Dean Norris is kind of sickened by the scene, and he goes to his car because, I think he's about to throw up.
Yeah.
But all the other agents are kind of watching your head on this turtle, and they're kind of like laughing and making fun of it, not realizing that the turtle is also carrying a bomb. It detonates, and all the other agents are blown up.
Right.
What was it like for you to see this facsimile, this model of your head, as if it were decapitated, riding on top of this turtle, mounted on top of this turtle?
I thought it was funny. I mean, it was kind of creepy because they did such a great job with the head, but it's just wow, nobody's ever done this in Hollywood. and my agent, Gloria, says, Danny, do you want to do one of Hollywood's first? And I said, what? She says, well, you're going to go across the desert on a turtle. And I thought, animation, that's a big turtle. And she goes, well, just your head. And I says, has anybody else done it? And they says, no. Has Sly done it? No. Has Schwarzenegger done it? No. Okay, then I'll do it.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Danny Trejo is a producer of the new documentary Survivor's Guide to Prison, which he also speaks in. It's available on iTunes and Amazon. Two very different kinds of books have just come out that explore mysteries, real and imagined. Agatha Christie by Laura Thompson is a biography of one of the greatest mystery writers of all time. And I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, who died in 2016, is a true crime story. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of both.
Both of the books I'm recommending today are each in their own way about cold cases. After all, what could be colder than the mysteries surrounding the life of that preeminent queen of crime, Agatha Christie? Christie, by some calculations, is the second best-selling author of all time, beaten by a hair by Shakespeare. She was a resolutely private person, and so has teased the legion of biographers who've been chipping away at her sphinx-like silence ever since she died in 1976. Surely by now you'd think there's nothing more to discover. But as every dedicated mystery reader knows, a gifted investigator sees what most of us mere mortals are blind to. Christie biographer Laura Thompson not only sees Christie's life more lucidly, but she's had a lot more material to peruse, letters and scraps of personal writing tucked into drawers and suitcases at Christie's beloved house in Devon. Thompson was also able to interview family members, including Christie's daughter Rosalind, before her death. The resulting triumph of a biography called Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life, was published a little over a decade ago in England, but is just now coming out here with a wobbly tie-in to the centenary of the completion of Christie's first novel, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. That's the book that ushered Hercule Poirot into the world. Whatever the excuse, it's wonderful to finally have Thompson's deep dive into Christie easily available. As every biographer must, Thompson takes readers through the familiar milestones of Christie's life. her idyllic childhood, her first marriage to a penniless aviator and cad, her notorious 11-day disappearance in 1926, and her happy second marriage to archaeologist Max Mallowan. But because Thompson is such a fine, close reader of Christie's deceptively dreamy personality and domestic world, she catches things others have missed. For instance, the fact that Christie's mother, Clara, was probably the love of her life. Thompson also digs into Christie's puzzling contradictions, her strange coldness to her own daughter, her staunch anti-feminist belief that men had better brains. And Thompson appreciates what she calls Christie's ordinary magic as a writer, her innate grasp of human nature, and her natural gift of translucency, that plainness of style that accounts for why Christie is still critically underrated. Christie was an obsessive about murder. After all, she wrote 80 novels, most of them murder mysteries. Journalist Michelle McNamara was also obsessed with murder, specifically researching and trying to crack cold cases. She created a popular website called True Crime Diary, and at the time of her sudden death in her sleep at the age of 46, McNamara was writing a book about her quest to track down the predator she dubbed the Golden State Killer. Beginning in the 1970s, this monster perpetrated 50 sexual assaults in Northern California and then moved south, where he committed 10 murders. In 1986, his sadistic spree mysteriously came to an end, though one of his victims swears she received a taunting phone call from him in 2001. The book McNamara was midway through writing at her death has been completed by colleagues familiar with her research. It's called I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is a boast the Golden State Killer made to one of his victims who survived. McNamara and her collaborators have written an unputdownable account of the crimes, the faded suburban California world where they took place, and the dogged police detectives who remain haunted by the case. Just as powerful is McNamara's investigation into her own obsession with the Golden State Killer. Her voice throughout is unfailingly smart and wry. She says at one point, "Sure, I'd love to clear the rot. I'm envious, for example, of people obsessed with the Civil War, which brims with details but is contained. In my case, the monsters recede but never vanish." McNamara was married to the comedian and actor Patton Oswalt, who's written a poignant afterword to this book where he compares his late wife to Hercule Poirot. "I was married to a crime fighter for a decade," Oswalt says, "and emphatically, for real, methodical, little gray cells, great brain type crime fighter." That's the hook, of course, of both Christie's mysteries and McNamara's true crime reportage, that reason will triumph over chaos and evil. And sometimes, even in real life, it does.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life, by Laura Thompson, and I'll Be Gone in the Dark, One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer, by the late Michelle McNamara. There's been a huge boon in the evolution of artificial intelligence over just the past 5 years, due to more high-powered computers, new kinds of programs, and an increasing pool of data to learn from. This has led to new developments such as driverless cars, machines that can carry on a conversation, and robots that can interpret medical scans. Today we're going to talk about this rapidly changing world of artificial intelligence and how these new high-tech developments may change our lives for better or worse. My guest, Cade Metz, covers artificial intelligence in his work as a tech correspondent for the New York Times. He was formerly a senior staff writer at Wired magazine. He's currently at work on a book about the visionaries behind new developments in artificial intelligence. We recorded this interview before a driverless car operated by Uber struck and killed a woman in Arizona. Cade Metz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been writing a lot about artificial intelligence, and you're writing a book about it too now. So let's talk about that. What is artificial intelligence? What do we mean now when we say it?
That's a really good question. And it's, on some levels, a hard question to answer, just because people tend to throw around this term, and they have for a long time, to describe almost anything. Anything that is automated in some way, or even any computing technology that's advancing the state of the art, even in a small or minor way, is described as artificial intelligence. It has a long history. It dates back to the 50s when this group of academics got together to truly build artificial intelligence, a machine that would mimic the intelligence of a human. But there's a very real change going on now, and it started about 5 years ago. And essentially, it's a fundamental change in the way that we build technology. What has changed now is that a certain type of computer algorithm, it's called a neural network, has started to work in ways that it did not work in the past. And what this algorithm allows us to do, allows those engineers to do, is build systems that can learn tasks on their own. So for instance, a neural network, if it analyzes millions of photos, it can learn to recognize faces and objects in those photos. Most of us have used Facebook. If you've ever used Facebook and you've posted a photo of friends and family, it can recognize those faces. Well, that's driven by one of these neural networks, which can learn that task on its own. We're also seeing these systems in speech recognition. So you can now bark commands into your cell phone. It can recognize what you say. It's used in machine translation, where machines translate from one language to another.
So let's back up. These are systems that can, what did you say, they could learn on their own?
Exactly. They're called neural networks, and that's a metaphor. They're meant to mimic the web of neurons in the brain. But really, they're just math. They're mathematical algorithms that analyze data. A group of millions of photos is just data, and these systems look for patterns in that data. The way a nose curves on a person's face, the way the lines of an eye come together, they can identify those patterns, the math of those visual patterns, for instance, and then learn to recognize what is in an image. In the same way, it can recognize patterns in voice data and learn to recognize what people say.
So another example you've mentioned in your reporting is how there are now some computers that can read scans to see, for instance, if there's a nodule in a lung that might be a sign of cancer.
Exactly. It's the same basic technology, the same technology that allows Facebook to recognize faces on its social network can allow machines to analyze medical scans and recognize when there are signs of illness and disease. It can be applied to lung scans, helping to identify cancer, retinal scans, helping to identify signs of diabetic blindness. As time goes on, we're going to see machines improve in this capacity, and what they can kind of do is provide a first line of defense against these types of diseases. That's particularly useful in, say, the developing world, where you don't have as many doctors. You can use these types of systems to analyze the scans of patients that would otherwise require a human doctor.
And so smart speakers, where you could tell the speaker what to play or what to turn on, that's also artificial intelligence, the same kind of learning pattern that you're describing.
It's exactly the same thing. So the Amazon Echo, which sits on the coffee tables of so many people now, or Siri on the iPhone. They train these systems using real human speech, and they learn to recognize what you say. The next step is really understanding what you say. I think what you'll notice, and this shows the limitations of AI today, the next step is to really truly understand what you say and act on it in a way that a human would. We're not there yet. These systems can recognize what you say and on some level understand. They can answer basic questions, but they can't really have a back and forth conversation the way you might expect them to, or you might want them to, or that might make it easier to really interact with machines.
On a related note, tell the story of the, I don't know what to call it, a computer or what, that was being taught speech and ended up picking up a lot of like racist terms and Holocaust denying expressions, and the company ended up discontinuing this.
That was an earlier Microsoft project called Tay, and it's kind of a famous example of these types of systems gone wrong. It had a serious design flaw. In many cases, it was just designed to repeat what the person had said to it in some way. And so humans interacting with this service online quickly realized this was the case, and they could kind of coax the system into saying these racist and xenophobic things. Microsoft immediately took it offline, and since then, the technology has seriously improved. These systems that learn on their own have come to the fore, and Microsoft sees a real path towards creating a conversational system. The problem is that Tay, this bot designed and deployed in the past by Microsoft, has created a real conundrum, not only for Microsoft, but for anyone else trying to build these conversational technologies. The thinking is that if you can get these new systems out in front of people and they will interact with them on their own and generate more conversational data, that these systems can use that data to train themselves in ever more proficient ways. But these companies are wary of putting them out there because they know they're going to make mistakes. They know that they're going to learn from those human biases in the data. They know they're going to offend people in the end. And, you know, these are big companies with brands and reputations to protect. And they see this as a real stumbling block to reaching the point where they can build truly conversational systems.
Now that we've learned so much about hacking through Russian interference in our election with like fake news and fake accounts on social media, the thought of there being robots that can be hacked by a malevolent actor is really scary, because if robots are designed to do important things, whether it's like, you know, reading a lung scan to see if a person has cancer, or whether it's a driverless car, if somebody can hack into that for devious reasons, that's kind of terrifying. So are designers worried about being able to adequately design safeguards?
They are certainly worried. There was a report recently pulled together by a group of technologists and researchers that looked at these very issues. And again, they are myriad. You know, you talk about the possibility of hacking in to an autonomous system, or, you know, certainly you can exploit its mistakes. Like I said, there are situations where these neural networks can be fooled into seeing things that aren't there, or failing to see things that are. That can be exploited by bad actors. But there are other issues that may be even closer. One of the things that these systems are doing extremely well and increasingly well is essentially fabricating images that look real. There was a team out of a company called NVIDIA. They're a chip maker, but they have an AI lab in Finland. And this team of researchers put together a system where essentially they built a neural network that analyzed millions of celebrity photos. And this system learned to build its own celebrity, essentially taking all those patterns that you see in pictures of Gwyneth Paltrow or whoever else you might imagine is in this database. And then it would build this celebrity, this fake celebrity that looked vaguely like someone you would see on the red carpet, but you couldn't quite identify. Think of the implications of that in the age of fake news, right? These techniques will soon be applied not only to still images like that, but to video and virtual reality. But even in the near term, as these systems become better and better at building fake images that look real, we're really going to have to change the way we look at anything we see online.
Okay, so another fear that you were right about that some people have about artificial intelligence, and I think these are designers who are worried about it, is the fear that AI systems will learn to prevent humans from turning them off. When I read this, of course, the first thing I thought of is the computer HAL in 2001 A Space Odyssey, because HAL is refusing to be turned off.
Right.
So would you elaborate on what this fear is, what the danger is?
You know, I like that you bring up HAL and 2001, one of my favorite movies, certainly. And I have to say it's the favorite movie of many of these AI researchers who are designing these systems. If you go into the personal conference room of the top AI researcher at Facebook, he's got images from 2001 all over this conference room. My point is that pop cultural images, movies, and books influence not only the way these designers think, but the way you and I think. We tend to think about those doomsday scenarios because we've thought about them a lot over the decades through pop culture, right? That said, among many of these researchers, there is a real concern that as time goes on, this will be a big problem, that these machines learn in ways that we cannot completely understand. If you have a car, for instance, that learns by, playing a video game, it plays the game so much that there are points where it's going to do things that we humans don't expect it to do. And as it reaches ever more for that higher point total, it's going to try to maximize its point total in every respect. The worry is that it's going to maximize it in ways that we don't want it to. That doomsday scenario is that if it's trying to get to the most points, well, it's not going to let us turn it off. Now, on some level, that, again, is not something that we can see happening anytime soon. That said, these systems that learn on their own are getting better and better, meaning the algorithms are getting better and better. And the hardware that runs these algorithms, that allows them to train with ever more speed, are getting better and better. And so the worry is that as we improve the algorithms, as we get faster computers, that we will somehow cross that threshold where the machines are really behaving in ways not only that we don't understand, but that we can't really control. And among many thinkers in this area, they're worried, even at this early stage, and it is early. If that ever happens, it's years and years away. But they're worried at this early stage that we will cross that threshold and not know it. What they say is that we might as well start thinking about it now because it is potentially such a risk. And when they make that argument, it's hard to argue back. Why not start worrying now and try to build safeguards into these systems rather than wait?
Can you give us an example of the kind of scenario where a bot would not allow itself to be turned off because it was pursuing the reward that it was programmed to pursue, like getting points for making the right decision?
There's a lab in San Francisco. It's called OpenAI, and it was founded by Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, among others. And they specialize in this reinforcement learning technology where these systems learn by extreme trial and error. And they were recently training a system to play a really old, kind of laughably clunky video game from the 80s or 90s. It's like a boat racing game, okay? And they trained it through this reinforcement learning method where essentially it plays the game over and over and over and tries to maximize its points. Well, this system learned in ways the designers didn't understand. Rather than trying to finish the race, which it should have done, it realized it could gain more points if it just ran into things and then spun back around and ran into other things and sort of tried to grab these sort of baubles that were around the course that awarded more points. And so it got into this crazy loop where it was just wreaking havoc across this game solely in an effort to gain points and wasn't trying to actually win the game. That, again, is a metaphor for the type of thing these researchers are worried about. And what they ended up doing is they ended up building an algorithm that allowed for human input. When the machine started doing things that like that, that were unexpected, the human designer could provide suggestions, give it a little nudge here or there, show that it needed to complete the race and not just wreak havoc.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Why did you start writing about technology?
Well, I have kind of a dual background. My mother is a voracious reader, a fiction reader mostly. My father was an engineer, and he was a career IBMer, a programmer. And so when I went to college, I was an English major, but I also interned at IBM as a programmer. So I always had this kind of dual interest, and it really comes from my parents.
What was the most amazing piece of technology that you got first because of your father?
Well, we had an IBM PC even before it was commercially available, is the way I remember it, about 1981 with the monochrome green display. I remember building a program that asked trivia questions. You know, it asked you who Pete Rose was, and you had to type in the answer.
So that helped lead you to the role that you play now?
That's a big part of it. And a lot of it was the stories my father would tell. He worked on the original project at IBM that designed the UPC symbol, the barcodes that are on all our groceries.
No kidding.
He worked to test that. And he was a great storyteller, had great stories about the development of that and all the myths that sort of surrounded it. There were people who protested the UPC symbol because they said it was the sign of the beast. You know, they had proof in Revelations from the Bible that this was going to lead the world to ruin. And there was a certain pride that I had when you would pick up a can of peas and see that symbol on the can.
Wow. Cade Metz, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cade Metz is a technology correspondent for the New York Times.